Welcome. Welcome to the Citizens Climate Lobby International Conference. My name is Mark Reynolds, and if you're joining us from the US or around the world, welcome. If you're from the US, there's people registered from all 50 states and the District of Columbia, and around the rest of the world, there's people from at least 27 other countries, and I want to welcome all of you. I'd also like to welcome you if this is the very first event you've ever done with Citizens Climate Lobby. Or maybe you're people that have been here from the start, so that I know of the original 20 volunteers that we had 12 or 13 years ago, at least four of them are here today: Amy Bennett, Olivia Malonis, Danny Richter, and Ann Engstrom. So whether you're brand new or you've been around for a while, welcome. You know, when I hear leaders in American business say that what we need is a durable, bipartisan, market-based solution, I feel more optimistic about this year than I've ever heard when major companies are now using our talking points. So what we're going to do over the next couple of days is everything we can to lay out us to be as in powerful a position as possible going into next year. And also for those of you that will be going to Senate and House offices virtually this week, that we have the best chance of success with them. So what's going to happen is, first of all, we're going to have a keynote panel that I'll be introducing the three people. We got the exact three people we wanted for this, and I'll explain why when I introduce them in just a moment. Then there'll be a strategy session with Vice President Danny Richter. This is really a carryover. If you're gonna be on the Hill with us this week, virtually, I hope that you'll make sure that you picked up the first two trainings that Danny did to position us to be effective on the Hill, but also the session's really designed for us to be powerful going into this year. The first set of breakout sessions are reaching out to specific groups of people: young people, people of color, conservatives. So it's very targeted training for outreach. Then you have a choice. You could take a break if you wanted, or there's an action team fair. We have 37 action teams who are hosting events. So that could be the health action team. It could be many of the different faith action teams that we have. And then really important sessions starting at 3:10 East Coast time are our state breakouts. We believe our path to success is through the Senate. And so it's important that the states get together, get a chance to plan next year, and get to figure out your plan for your particular members of the Senate. The next set of breakouts are more around building political will, tools to build political will. So we'll have those. And then the closing remarks, we'll have, first of all, Representative Ted Deutsch talking about his vision for reintroduction of the bill next year. And then Dr. Natasha DeJarnett, who is our incoming board president, and as the incoming governing board president, will talk about her vision for Citizens Climate Lobby for 2021. We also have sessions tomorrow. All those sessions tomorrow are standalone. And so they're 2 to 3 hours long. They start at this time also. There's a, first of all, kind of the super wonky one, a closer look at carbon pricing studies, and then also We're not going to emphasize the June analysis of our June meetings as much in this week's lobbying as we have in previous years, but there's a lot of really interesting stuff that we found in new ways it can be presented, so I think you'll like that. The next session, Bridging the Divide on Climate Solutions by Braver Angels. If you've done a Braver Angels workshop with us, this is not that one. This is a new one. This is specifically about the area of solutions, and then a lens into race and climate. And then the fourth session is Envisioning Climate Success in Your Next Steps. That's with our own Peterson Toscano, the head of CCL Radio. And he's just really brilliant at having people envisioning a future and at being able to work powerfully into that. Okay, what about our panel for this morning? So first of all, we have Professor Hari Hahn. Professor Hahn is a political science professor at Johns Hopkins University. She's been published extensively, including 4 books. But there's a couple of things that I want to say about her. One is the first time that Hari was on our call as a guest, she talked about the difference between transactional and transformational advocacy. In transactional advocacy, you just ask people to do something. In transformational advocacy, the people are also really important. And we had kind of an epiphany as an organization in that moment, realizing that we could be 100% dedicated to what we needed to do, but we could be 100% dedicated to our people, and that there was no conflict there. So that was a really important moment for the organization. Similarly, Xiling Su, professor of law at Florida State University, we have sent hundreds of copies of Schilling's book, A Case for a Carbon Tax, for our chapters, hundreds. I might be the biggest purchaser of Schilling's book in the country because, you know, we've been working on one thing, which is the price. And Schilling did such a brilliant way of laying out the potential impact of price in a marketplace. So we're so happy that Schilling could join us also. And then John Ward Jr., the Director of Public Outreach for Braver Angels, previously the Vice Chairman of the Republican Party of LA County. So, you know, everybody can point to other people and say, look how they're biased. You know, that's easy. Anybody can do it. Oh, see how biased they are? This shows how they're stuck on their position. It's way harder, more complicated work to say, I'm going to look at myself and understand my own biases. More important work. For us to be successful, we have to be successful with the kind of work that John is doing with his organization, is having people come to terms with their own biases. Maybe we have a way better chance of hearing other people if we understand ourselves. So I asked each of our panelists to start with an opening 3 to 5 minute statement about what the challenges and opportunities they see for this year. And then hopefully we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. But first of all, welcome all three of you. You are the three people we wanted. And so happy that you can be here. And John Wood Jr., let's start with you, please.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful to be here, folks. Citizens Climate Lobby is one of my favorite organizations in all of America, not just because the issue that you guys care about is one that is of, you know, deep concern to me as well, but because the way you guys do democracy, I think, is an inspirational model for anybody who wants to see genuine progress take place in this country across a range of issues, but broadly speaking, in our ability to work together in what we would call civic friendship. At Braver Angels. And so just a quick note, Braver Angels is a bipartisan organization. We have members and folks all across the country. We don't take positions on particular policy issues, but what's true is that because we speak and work beyond the stereotypes, our organization is a home for folks who oftentimes care about an issue deeply that sort of bucks the trend in their own party. And so I've had the pleasure of being able to work alongside people of both parties, but certainly Republicans, certainly conservatives who care deeply about this issue. And I think that there's tremendous opportunity when you look out across the landscape of the country for progress here, because whether you're looking at the excitement, the enthusiasm that bubbled up with respect to the Green New Deal, whether or not you're looking at the work of Representative McCarthy and Dan Crenshaw and prominent GOP leaders in Congress seeking to find solutions in the area of addressing climate change that speak to the language of their constituents. When you look at the work that not only this organization is doing, but organizations such as the American Conservation Coalition, run by really sharp young guys who are deeply enmeshed in the conservative movement, but who are seeking to reframe the conversation in a bipartisan, coalitional way, you realize the fact that the significance of our shared concern for the environment, our shared concern for the climate, is real in America. Polls overwhelmingly show that anywhere from 2/3 to 3/4 of the American people see climate change as a real issue. But the headwinds are strong too. Just speaking for myself as an individual, I'm pleased to see that in the Climate Solutions Caucus, the work of Senator Chris Coons and Mike Braun, that you have a strong bipartisan coalition. But if you look at the roster of Republicans who are on that list, great public servants, folks who are taking a strong and a constructive stand on this question. But if you look at the geographic spread, we find that we have, I think, one representative from the state of Kentucky, one from Virginia, maybe one from South Carolina. But broadly speaking, the region of the South is not well represented in that coalition. This tracks with the fact that we do have folks in the evangelical and religious communities who are concerned with the environment, who are part of their own networks that are doing good work, but they find themselves out of dialogue over the issue of climate change and the environment because one side speaks a language of stewardship, but many activists on the left wish to speak the language of social justice with respect to climate advocacy. And all of this is just fine, of course, so long as we can see where it is our values really do meet in the middle and create space for a humanizing conversation that allows each of our philosophical starting points to lead us to where, towards a shared strategy for success in the preservation of our resources, the preservation of our habitat and our ecology, all the things that matter to us in our environment. But so long as the conversation is polarized, not just between people who agree or disagree with respect to whether or not climate change is a problem, but between people who agree or disagree with respect to where we should be starting from in terms of our relationship to this issue, then we won't make progress. So the opportunity we have today is to reframe the narrative in a way that makes space for the broad spectrum of American sentiments in relationship to the environment so that we can truly forge a coalition, and I say this for myself as a person who cares about this issue, so that we can truly forge a coalition that can make progress, that can endure and bring all Americans into this space. And CCL is an absolutely vital vehicle for helping to make that happen. So I'm just happy to be here sharing the stage today.
Great, thank you so much, John. Professor Hahn, nice to see you, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much, Mark. Like John, I'm really honored to be invited to come and talk to you all today and excited to have this opportunity to share the stage with John and Dr. Xu, but then also to be a part of the event with all of you. I'm only sorry that we can't be gathering in person, but hopefully someday soon. So I thought in thinking about the kind of possibilities for, climate change, for change, on climate policy in the coming administration. When I began thinking about what I wanted to say, I sort of started with this idea of, well, what's the counter narrative, right? What's the counter argument for why change isn't possible? And I think that one of the things that I hear a lot from people who are reflecting on the election that just happened and some of the patterns, the results that we're beginning to see is this notion that clearly what the election shows us is that the country is very divided, that we have deep divisions that haven't changed after 4 years, even after a global pandemic and a big economic downturn and all these other things. And it seems like there's this moment of stasis that makes change on big issues like climate policy really challenging. But another way to look at that is to think about the fact that I think another pattern that we see from a lot of our election results is that control of our political institutions keeps flipping back and forth between the political parties. And we see that in the United States, we see sort of patterns of that in other westernized democracies around the world. And I think what that means is that we're in this moment of uncertainty right now, certainly in the United States, definitely also in other places around the world. And there's no one party or one leader that has clearly articulated a big vision or a solution that a majority of the population is ready to glom onto. And that's why we see that constant flipping back and forth in the partisan control of political institutions, is that one party gains power, half the country is unhappy, the other party gains power, the other half the country is unhappy, and you see that kind of flipping back and forth. And I think that what that means is not that big change is hard to do, but instead that big change is necessary in a moment like this, right? That we need something that's gonna capture the, that it's gonna be able to sort of capture the sort of vision and articulate sort of a new path forward. And the kind of work that Citizens Climate Lobby is doing around the carbon tax, I think is exactly that kind of vision, right? It's a vision that can bring lots of different pockets of society together and can begin to make possible a new society. But the challenge is that we have to think about how we make that possible in terms of what I think of as the politics of possibility, right? And so what that means is, a lot of times when you look at a lot of the, punditry and the kind of analysis that goes on in political circles, it operates in what I think of as a politics of probability, right? It sort of looks at all the data and it sort of says, well, here's the most probable outcome, right? And so here's a secret. If you're on the side of change, the most probable outcome is always that change will fail, right? But what the history of social change shows us is that change only happens when you have a group of committed people who are working to make possible a new vision for a world that they want. Famously when FDR was elected president in 1932, he has, been governor of New York, and then he became president, and there was a labor leader that he had worked with you know, for many years in New York. And then that labor leader came and visited him at the White House and said, well, you know, I just helped get you elected in the White House. And so here's this list of things that I want you to do for labor. And FDR famously responded, well, make me do it. You know, the idea being that, you know, now that we're here, like if the people ask for something, it's easier for me to be able to make the change that I want to make happen. And similarly, when Martin Luther King had been negotiating his relationship with LBJ during the civil rights movement, you know, they had just passed the Civil Rights Act and they wanted to pass the Voting Rights Act, but LBJ had just used all his political capital in getting the Civil Rights Act passed, you know? And so Martin Luther King comes and visits him and says, hey, we're not done yet, right? We still have to pass the Voting Rights Act. And LBJ reverts back to FDR's statement and says, make me do it, you know? And I feel like we're in a moment right now where the administration, whether we think about in terms of the president or in terms of whichever party ends up controlling Congress, is in a situation where they need the public to make them do it, right? That they will only make the kind of change that we want if they feel like there's a base out there that's going to provide them with the cover and hold them accountable to the things that we want. And so one of the things that you know, we've looked at a lot in the research that we've done on social movements and how they work is kind of this insight that Mark was referring to before, which is that how we do our work makes possible what we're able to do. And I think oftentimes when we're trying to make big policy change in moments like this where it feels really fraught, it feels like we have to sort of take all the shortcuts in order to just like get the thing done. And I think what a lot of the sort of history shows us, if you look at it carefully, is that the big change always comes from doing that transformational work with the people that we engage. And I think if Citizens Climate Lobby continues to build on, I know, all the kind of the roiling energy that we see in the communities across the country, that will begin to make possible that sort of notion of the politics of possibility that we need right now.
Wow, okay. Thanks, Hari. Xiling.
Well, thanks, Mark. Thanks, Hari and John. I'm delighted and honored to be a part of this panel. I hate to be a downer. I kind of came into this a little discouraged by the outcome of the elections. I think we're the vast majority of us are relieved that Donald Trump will be out of the White House in 46 days. But I see a Republican Party that is ascendant that still seems quite beholden to Trumpism, which is bigger than we thought it was going to be. Only 25 of the Republican members of Congress have actually acknowledged that Joe Biden won the election. And I see in that group some greater challenges than Citizens Climate Lobby has faced in the past in just talking to them. It's hard to see that talking to them would actually kind of change their minds. Now, you know, I agree though with Hari and John. It's you know, it's hard work, and Citizens Climate Lobby has always been there to do it. I've always said that Citizens Climate Lobby, with its respectfulness for everyone, is the antidote to polarization. I just think that it's going to be harder to deal with members of Congress than it has been in the past. I think with that in mind, what everyone, including Citizens Climate Lobby, could do is to look for, you know, the next Curbelo, the next Rooney, the next Rose Lehtinen, and perhaps Mike Braun is there. You know, unexpectedly, John Barrasso of Wyoming is kind of expressed some interest in climate policy. And, you know, Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, there are a few people out there that could be kind of persuadable. I guess what I think about are new frontiers for Citizens Climate Lobby, and where I see a lot of promise is at the state and local level. Now, I know that's not what Citizens Climate Lobby kind of traditionally does, but there are vibrant state and local chapters that are very effective in interfacing with state and local officials. And I think that is an area of promise. At the local level, it's just less ideological. I had lunch with a former student yesterday who has developed a vibrant practice in representing local governments in Florida, and some of them very, very red. many of them very interested in climate change and adaptation in particular. So, you know, one of the things that could be accomplished in addition to trying to kind of continue to chip away at Congress is to kind of talk with state and local officials, maybe partner with them, maybe get them involved with the lobbying. There are various ways that members of Congress might listen to state and local officials that would be an additional voice in addition to that of Citizens Climate Lobbying. And from the state and local government perspective, this wouldn't necessarily be federal action, but I think they would be receptive to a carbon price that because they want to fund certain adaptation projects. Gosh, they want to fund anything. The COVID crisis has decimated state and local government debt budgets. I think the new bill from the Democrats has about $160 billion for state and local governments. That's nowhere near enough to fill the gaps that are left behind by the COVID crisis. So, you know, you hear this from kind of fiscal kind of hawks on the federal level, how a carbon tax could fill the federal budget deficit. I think at the local level, it might be even more so. I want to kind of show one more thing that could be done. It is, I think, a kind of a problem with the way that carbon fee even is perceived. I think Citizens Climate Lobby was savvy to call it carbon fee instead of a carbon tax. But, you know, I think this is a problem, and this is a bipartisan problem about the way that people view a carbon fee or a carbon tax. It's that it's always being compared to something that sounds better. These are two questions that were posed by the Democratic National Campaign Committee. I forgot what the third C stands for. But you can see here are the questions that are posed to survey respondents. Would you support or oppose a policy levying a new tax on carbon pollution to reduce pollution and protect the environment? Fine. Question B, would you support or oppose a policy providing for public investment in clean energy infrastructure and requiring carbon emissions reductions through regulation to reduce pollution and protect the environment? I contend that you look at those two questions and the vast majority of people will gravitate towards B, because B doesn't sound like it costs them anything. And A, you know, levying a new tax or just kind of almost toxic words. I don't think that's the right way to do polling. And I think that if we could just reframe these questions, ask better fiscal questions, that would be a start towards changing the way people see carbon taxes and carbon fees. I think still people perceive the price when they talk about that. So anyway, you know, the epilogue of this is that the Democratic Party polled Democratic voters, and not surprisingly, the vast majority of them were much, much more receptive to B than they were A. And I think what we have to do is just try and flip that perception a little bit and be a little bit more perhaps long-winded about climate policy and to make sure that respondents understand, spend more than just, you know, 60 seconds thinking about policy. So anyway, I kind of remain, Citizens Climate Lobby always makes me feel better. I just kind of start with the point of view that there's some challenges that I might not have expected we would have to face at this point.
Yeah, thank you, Shiling. So great to have you on also. Just a few things about that, and then I have specific questions for each of the panelists. We actually have done over the last couple of years quite a bit of work in states with some great successes, and also had a lot of success getting state legislatures and mayors to endorse fee and dividend. And we believe that's very influential on the Hill also, so there's been a lot of work. And regarding why we call it a fee or a tax, I remember being in former Secretary of State Schultz's office, who said, taxes grow government, that's why you should call this a fee. And I only brought that up because he turns 100 next week. So I was looking for an excuse at some point during the course of this day to wish former Secretary Schultz a happy birthday. Hari, I'd like to start with you. And I, you know, I just found that phrase, the, oh gosh, the I don't know what you called it, of possibility, but you contrasted it with probability. And we're an organization that certainly has tried to organize itself, not around what people think can be done, but what has to be done. And if you could elaborate a little bit more on, was it the politics of possibility? Was that the word you used? Yeah, could you just expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So there's been research that sort of looks at how likely policy change is to happen in the U.S. Congress, right? And there's probably the best study on this is one that took a random sample of issues in the U.S. Congress in the early 21st century and then followed them over the course of like 5 to 10 years. I can't remember exactly what it was, to try to see like how often we saw policy change. Right. And by taking a random sample, what it meant was that they got some issues that were super high on the political agenda. This is in the early 21st century. So things like healthcare reform before the Affordable Care Act had passed, climate change issues were on there, immigration reform, like all the different things. And also really small issues like reform of the U.S. Postal Service or reform of NASA or things that don't get as much public attention. And regardless of the type of issue, what they found is that in tracing the arc of the issue over a 5 or 10 year period, the probability of change is extremely low. It's something like 10%, And so what that means is that if you're on the side of trying to make change, whether it's around carbon tax or anything else, right, the chances that's gonna happen are low, right? And so if you were to look at the probabilities and say, here I am, should I spend my time on doing this? Then probabilistically speaking, the answer is no, because it's not gonna, 90% of the time, nothing happens, right? We get status quo. But then if you look, so then the question is, okay, so then if we're in a situation like we are now, where clearly change has to happen in order to meet the looming challenge of climate change, for example, then what is it that we can do? Then the question is, well, how do I make possible the change that we want to see? And that's where a lot of the research that we do has been grounded, is this question of, it's not to sort of ignore the challenges that Dr. Hsu is laying out, or the challenges of the fact that 90% of the time you get status quo, but instead to sort of say, well, where are the places, where are the levers that you can pull to make change possible? And the levers that you can pull on sort of situations like this very often have to do with the extent to which the elected officials feel like they are being held accountable to a base of people who are going to help them achieve their other agenda, like help them achieve re-election, help them achieve other policy priorities, like all these different kind of things. And so the extent to which you have this like active base in the districts and in the communities is way more predictive of the extent to which you are able whether you're able to sort of beat the probabilities or not. And that, I think, is what I meant by the politics of possibility.
Great, thank you for that. John, I want to follow up with you also. So obviously the people on the edges of both parties make the most noise. So it makes it seem like they're representing the majority of Americans' opinions. But I want to ask you about other organizations that are doing similar work. Do you find momentum working more towards Braver Angels, or do you feel like you're out there on your own trying to work in a nonpartisan, bipartisan space?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a great deal of momentum in the direction of recognizing the fact that the polarization of American political society and just our social culture in general is, in a sense, sort of not just the main cultural, but the main structural headwind facing, just the widest possible range of problems that need to be solved. And so, there's increasing attention coming into this space from funders, from politicians and public figures. I mean, Joe Biden, quite honestly, I mean, he's speaking a language of unity that is, I think, well-timed and very much welcomed from me, Braver Angels, and others in the space. So all of that is positive, but at the same time, there's a certain sort of precarious moment we find ourselves in, to where even the language of unity and depolarization threatens itself to become polarized and politicized in the context of the aftermath of an election, where inevitably it's easier for the victors to speak in terms of unity than it is for the losers. And that's taking out, the the, you know, real or imagined, you know, sense that there were things that happened in the election that might undermine its credibility in the eyes of folks who don't like, who may not like the outcome. So these are serious headwinds towards building the type of shared civic trust that would allow us to sort of make the progress we would want to see in the face of what this larger opportunity is. So in other words, people see that we need to come together, but the trust still needs to be built. But that's always going to be the case in one way or another. I think the thing to emphasize here is the fact that, Hari, you were talking about finding the levers through which progress is made. And I've heard you speak in terms of the dichotomy between mobilization and organization. I'm a big fan of Dr. Hari's, by the way. I think that we have to recognize the fact that while the issue of climate change is urgent, we still have to be urgently patient in the way we go about organizing in a manner that allows folks to make the most impact, right? Because there is space in civil society, in local communities, to Dr. Sue's point, there is space to organize in a way that allows us to build communities together and reframe the narratives from the ground level up. And that affects the way elected officials think. But breaking through the national narrative in one bold stroke is a hard thing to do. We need to be urgently patient in how we build and organize together to create the space for the new consensus to form.
I like that phrase, urgently patient. It reminded me, our guest speaker for our call next month is Christine Figueres, who put the whole Paris Agreement together. And she said, we need to be stubbornly optimistic, which I like that also. Shiling, I want to ask you about what influence you think the business community can have this round, because we're seeing more statements from large American companies. You saw the Business Roundtable speak out in favor of a carbon tax. Do you think they're ready to start wielding their influence on policy getting done? I mean, what businesses want is predictability. And that's one of the reasons so many people are in favor of a carbon tax as a way of mitigating global climate change, is it gives them a predictable future. But what do you think about the likelihood of getting support from that community?
You know, I think that is very important. I'd like to kind of just build on a point that Hari and John made about stubborn optimism, or maybe it was you that coined that phrase, but both of them spoke to that. And one of the things about Citizens Climate Lobby that is so inspiring, frankly, is that, you know, climate change is hard, and we won't do it in one bold stroke, but hopefulness or optimism, it may not be a sufficient condition, but is it a necessary one? And if you are willing to accept the proposition that something has to be done, then there really is no other option just to be optimistic, be kind of patient, and work forward and hope it works out. And if it doesn't work out, if we do have a lot of climate disasters, then at least we will have gone down swinging. The business community is interesting. I think the business community has already, I think, moved well past kind of a debate about climate change and the need for carbon pricing. I think they would probably support carbon pricing. I think they still just need to have some cover, ironically, from the politicians themselves. If you think about Walmart, for example, you know, they have already been at it for a decade in terms of trying to reduce their own carbon footprint and reduce that of their suppliers. A lot of them, like Walmart, have the market power to actually just do climate policy on themselves. This is an area of kind of scholarship that's been referred to as private environmental governance. And I think, you know, if business could be kind of convinced that it would be in their, not just economic, political interests to kind of support carbon price, they could be brought on board. I think a lot of them are really quite open about the need to address climate change, and probably a lot of them are quite open about the need to do it through a carbon price. What I think would help the business community is to kind of convince them that if, for example, you know, Walmart came out in favor of a carbon price, that there wouldn't be someone like Steve Scalise running around saying boycott Walmart, they're in favor of socialism, right? I think that is kind of in the politics of polarization, businesses have to be protected from kind of blowback about stuff. We already kind of see this in kind of the gun policy area where kind of Walmarts and Dick's are trying to kind of tread very carefully in between kind of doing something that they feel is socially responsible and alienating some of their customers. So I think businesses probably do what they can. And if they feel confident, they're not going to be attacked for supporting a carbon price, I think they would.
Thank you for that. I want to just shift directions a tiny bit here because outreach is so important to us as an organization. And so we were going into Earth Day this year. We had hundreds of tabling events set up. We had all these talks we were going to give. We were going to reach out to the public, and then we couldn't do it. And so, you know, I read an interview with Cesar Chavez one time where he talked about how he did organizing. They're like, what's the magic? How do you do it? And he said, you know, I talk to one person, and when I'm done talking to that person, I talk to the next person. They're like, no, not that part. You know, tell us, how do you mobilize thousands of people? And he goes, well, I talk to one person, and then I talk to another person. And so we're kind of that organization. And I saw an interview with Bill Gates where he said, you know, he thinks we'll be in this situation for the next 6 to 9 months. And so, Hari, I was particularly interested in, do you have any advice or guidance to our people of, you know, how do we continue to effectively do outreach and reach out to groups in a limited world?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, certainly COVID has changed the way we all interact, not only in the kind of public work that we do, but also in our own family lives. And it's hard to underestimate how profound the changes have been to everyone's lives. That being said, I agree with Susan Chavez on this one, you know, in terms of the fact that doing the work of outreach is about the conversation, and it's about the interpersonal connection that you make with other people. And I think one of the things that all of us are finding is that we can still maintain the connections that we have with each other and build new ones in digital ways, right? So yes, an in-person meeting can sometimes make that easier in a lot of ways, but it's not to say that there aren't all sorts of creative ways in which we can continue to work with each other. Now, how do you get that to scale, right? So what Cesar Chavez doesn't talk about is that, yes, he talks to one person, then he talks to another person, but how do those two conversations become thousands of people, right? And the way that you get that to scale is not a function of the mode within which we're speaking, but it's more a function of the extent to which each of the people that you're talking to are then invested with the responsibility to talk to other people. And that's how you get exponential growth, right? So if I have 5 conversations, each of those 5 people then have 5 more conversations, that gets to 25, and then 25 gets, you know, each of those has another 5, and all of a sudden you're at 125, and then it continues to grow exponentially like that. And so, you know, when we look at the data, the cloud around organizing only happens when you distribute responsibility so that people who are at the ends of that 125 to the next 5, you know, feel like they have ownership over the work that they're doing in reaching out to others. And so that's how one person becomes 1,000 people, whether it's over Zoom or over the phone or in person.
Thank you. I think that's important for our people to hear that right now. I want to just check with Flannery. Flannery, are there big themes in the questions that we should address because they're being asked a lot?
Yes, we have some questions for John. People are asking, who are the advocates that we have yet to bring into our advocacy for carbon pricing? One person said that we have corporations, there are elder statesmen Republicans, there are centrist politicians, there's faith community. Who else do we need to bring into the conversation?
Yeah, so let me answer that. Well, first of all, you guys may be in dialogue with groups and leaders that I'm not aware of, certainly. I do think that ultimately, if you're just looking at the macro demographics of American society, the reason in my opening remarks I mentioned the fact that within the Solutions Caucus you don't see much representation from the South is because, you know, that maps onto the core base of support that President Donald Trump has enjoyed. It maps on to the larger kind of sort of evangelical and Protestant community in the United States. And, you know, sadly on this particular issue, there's a real sort of communication firewall that's been hard to break through for various reasons, because the language is so polarized. So, and you know, for reasons deeper than that. I don't know if you guys have a relationship with the Evangelical Environmental Network. If you guys, okay, well, that's wonderful to hear. I think that when the lockdown went into effect, Braver Angels was faced with a moment that we thought could be just terribly destructive for the work that we do, because so much of what we had done had rested on in-person gatherings, right? It turned out that, in fact, shifting everything online wound up being an amazing opportunity for us to scale our reach, our ability to connect with not just greater numbers of people across greater distances, geographically speaking, but also influential individuals who are in networks that we wouldn't have been able to reach before, but who now had time on their hands and could do things with us virtually. I would strategically look for leaders within the evangelical community, leaders in the South, leaders across sectors, but geographically concentrated here, but also folks, I would say, in the African-American community, particularly in the African-American church community, who may be able to speak a language of social justice on the one hand, but who see and appreciate the issue facing us with respect to climate change, and who can communicate in an evangelical vernacular. Bring these sorts of folks in conversations together where we can have an environmental dialogue that's rooted in sort of a moral and cultural framework that people can share in a religious context across parties, across race, and across geographies. And in so doing, I think that we can begin to sort of humanize the work of environmental advocacy, the work of CCL in particular, in a way that can begin to travel across some of these invisible walls that exist between us on the basis of not just party, but in particular, geography, and even some of these sorts of religious secular divisions. Strategic networking is key, and there are many ways in which operating virtually or digitally actually make it easier to find opportunities to make your way through some of those holes in the wall to build those connections.
Yeah, we found something very similar in that, you know, we usually do two conferences in DC, one in June and one in November. And we did the June conference virtually. And in both cases, we lobby for the week after. Mm-hmm. And in 20% of meetings after June, we had local influencers who wouldn't have come to DC with us. So we got voices in the room that otherwise wouldn't have been in the room. I think we'll see something similar this week. And then also in one case of a meeting with a Michigan senator, there was over 150 people. We've never been able to cram 150 people into a Senate office, but doing it virtually certainly raised opportunities. Well, this certainly exceeded my expectations, and my expectations were high because we have a really, you know, high regard for all three of you and appreciate very much that you made yourself available. You're certainly welcome to join us. I think there's a lot of interesting things happening the rest of the day, but I know some of your parents and the challenges of a weekend and these days of how challenging our lives are already. But thank you all so much. It's great to see the three of you, and I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you. It's great to see you all.
Thank you. Oh, thanks. Great. That was fantastic. Okay, so many of you know that our year-end campaign for fundraising started on Giving Tuesday. We had a goal to raise $1 million from Giving Tuesday until the end of the year. We had a goal on Giving Tuesday itself to raise $200,000. If we raised $200,000, there was a $100,000 matching grant. We raised $315,167 on Giving Tuesday. So that matching grant is in place. And at 7 o'clock my time this morning, we were at $499,749 towards our goal of getting to $1 million. So for everybody who've been able to contribute, thank you so much for doing that. If you're still considering it, we really, really appreciated it. And we just wanted to share with you a just under a minute video, just talking about that moment and just chance to say thank you.
I support the Energy Innovation Act.
I just want to voice my support for the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.